Side 7, The Dark Half, by Stephen King, continuing on page 252. 3. There was a small bathroom off the study, and when Thad felt able to walk, he took his monstrously throbbing hand there and examined the wound under the harsh glare of the overhead fluorescent tube. It looked like a bullet wound, a perfectly round hole rimmed with a flaring black smudge. The smudge looked like gunpowder, not graphite. He turned his hand over and saw a bright red dot, the size of a pinprick, on the palm side, the tip of the pencil. That's how close it came to going all the way through, he thought. He ran cold water over and into the wound until his hand was numb, then took the bottle of hydrogen peroxide from the cabinet. He found he could not hold the bottle in his left hand, so he pressed it against his body with his left arm in order to get the cap off. Then he poured disinfectant into the hole in his hand, watching the liquid turn white and foam, gritting his teeth against the pain. He put the hydrogen peroxide back and then took down the few bottles of prescription medicine in the cabinet one by one, examining their labels. He had had terrible back spasms after a fall he had taken while cross-country skiing 2 years ago, and good old Dr. Hume had given him a prescription for Percodan. He had taken only a few of them. He had found the pills fucked up his sleep cycle and made it hard for him to write. He finally discovered the plastic vial hiding behind a can of Barbasol shaving cream that had to be at least 1,000 years old. Thad pried the vial's cap off with his teeth and shook one of the pills out onto the side of the sink. He debated adding a second and decided against it. They were strong. And maybe they're spoiled. Maybe you can end this wild night of fun with a good convulsion and a trip to the hospital. How about that? But he decided to take the chance. There really wasn't even a question. The pain was immense, incredible. As for the hospital, he looked at the wound in his hand again and thought, probably I should go and have this looked at, but I'll be goddamned if I will. I've had enough people looking at me like I was crazy in the last few days to last me a lifetime. He scooped up another 4 Percodans, stuffed them into his pants pocket, and returned the vial to the medicine cabinet shelf. Then he covered the wound with a Band-Aid. One of the round spots did the trick. Looking at that little circle of plastic, he thought, you'd have no idea how badly the damned thing hurts. He set a bear trap for me, a bear trap in his mind, and I walked right into it. Was that really what had happened? Thad didn't know, not for sure. But he knew one thing. He did not want a repeat performance. 4. When he had himself under control again, or something approaching it, Thad returned his journal to his desk drawer, turned off the lights in the study, and went down to the second floor. He paused in the landing, listening for a moment. The twins were quiet, so was Liz. The Percodan, apparently not too old to work, began to kick in, and the pain in Thad's hand began to back off a little. If he inadvertently flexed it, the low throb there turned into a scream. But if he was careful of it, it wasn't too bad. Oh, but it's going to hurt in the morning, buddy. And what are you going to tell Liz? He didn't know exactly. Probably the truth, or some of it anyway. She had gotten very skilled, it seemed, at picking up on his lies. The pain was better, but the after effects of the sudden shock, all the sudden shocks, still lingered. And he thought it would be some time yet before he could sleep. He went down to the first floor and peeked out at the state police cruiser parked in the driveway through the shears drawn across the big living room window. He could see the firefly flicker of 2 cigarettes inside. They're sitting there just as cool as a pair of summer cucumbers, he thought. The birds didn't bother them any, so maybe there really weren't any, except in my head. After all, these guys get paid to be bothered. It was a tempting idea, but the study was on the other side of the house. Its windows could not be seen from the driveway. Neither could the carriage house. So the cops couldn't have seen the birds anyway. Not at least when they began to roost. But what about when they all flew away? You want to tell me they didn't hear that? You saw at least 100 of them, Thad. Maybe 200 or 300. Thad went outside. He had hardly done more than open the kitchen screen door before both troopers were out of the car, one on each side. They were big men who moved with the silent speed of ocelots. Did he call again, Mr. Beaumont? The one who had gotten out on the driver's side asked. His name was Stevens. No, nothing like that, Thad said. I was writing in my study when I thought I heard a whole bunch of birds take off. It freaked me out a little. Did you guys hear that? Thad didn't know the name of the cop who had gotten out on the passenger side. He was young and blonde, with one of those round, guileless faces which radiate good nature. "Heard 'em and saw 'em both," he said. He pointed to the sky, where the moon, a little past the first quarter, hung above the house. "They flew right across the moon, sparrows, quite a flock of 'em. They hardly ever fly at night." "Where do you suppose they came from?" Thad asked.
"Well, I tell you," the trooper with the round face said.
"I don't know. I flunked bird surveillance." He laughed. The other trooper did not.
"Feeling jumpy tonight, Mr. Beaumont?" he asked.
Thad looked at him levelly. "Yes," he said. "I've been feeling jumpy every night just lately."
"Could we do anything for you just now, sir?"
"No," Thad said. "I think not. I was just curious about what I heard. Good night, you guys."
"Night," the round-faced trooper said.
Stevens only nodded. His eyes were bright and expressionless below the wide brim of his trooper's Stetson. "That one thinks I'm guilty," Thad thought, going back up the walk. "Of what?" "He doesn't know. Probably doesn't care. But he's got the face of a man who believes everyone is guilty of something. Who knows? Maybe he's even right."
He closed the kitchen door and locked it behind him. He went back into the living room and looked out again. The trooper with the round face had retreated back into the cruiser, but Stevens was still standing on the driver's side, and for a moment Thad had the impression that Stevens was looking directly into his eyes. It couldn't be, of course, with the shears drawn. Stevens would see only an indistinct dark shape, if he saw anything at all. Still, the impression lingered. Thad drew the drapes over the shears and went to the liquor cabinet. He opened it and took out a bottle of Glenlivet, which had always been his favorite tipple. He looked at it for a long moment and then put it back. He wanted to drink very badly, but this would be the worst time in history to start drinking again. He went out to the kitchen and poured himself a glass of milk, being very careful not to bend his left hand. The wound had a brittle, hot feel.
"He came in vague," he thought, sipping the milk. "It didn't last long. He sharpened up so fast it was scary. But he came in vague. I think he was asleep. He might have been dreaming of Miriam, but I don't think so. What I tapped into was too coherent to be a dream. I think it was memory. I think it was George Stark's subconscious hall of records, where everything is neatly written down and then filed in its own slot. I imagine that if he tapped my subconscious, and for all I know, maybe he already has, he'd find the same sort of thing." He sipped his milk and looked at the pantry door. "I wonder if I could tap into his waking thoughts, his conscious thoughts." He thought the answer was yes, but he also thought it would render him vulnerable again. And next time it might not be a pencil in the hand. Next time it might be a letter opener in the neck. "He can't. He needs me." "Yeah, but he's crazy. Crazy people are not always hip to their own best interests." He looked at the pantry door and thought about how he could go in there, and from there outside again, on the other side of the house. Could I make him do something, the way he made me do something? He could not answer that one, at least not yet, and one failed experiment might kill him. Thad finished his milk, rinsed his glass, and put it into the dish drainer. Then he went into the pantry. Here, between shelves of canned goods on the right and shelves of paper goods on the left, was a Dutch door leading out to the wide expanse of lawn which they called the backyard. He unlocked the door, pushed both halves open, and saw the picnic table and the barbecue out there, standing silent sentinel. He walked out onto the asphalt walk which ran around this side of the house and finally joined the main walk in front. The walk glimmered like black glass in the chancy light of the half moon. He could see white splotches on it at irregular intervals. "Sparrow shit, not to put too fine a point on it," he thought. Thad walked slowly up the asphalt path until he was standing directly below his study windows. An Orinco truck came over the horizon and pelted down Route 15 toward the house, casting a momentary bright light across the lawn and the asphalt walk. In this brief light, Thad saw the corpses of two sparrows lying on the walk.
tiny heaps of feathers with trifurcate feet sticking out of them. Then the truck was gone. In the moonlight, the bodies of the dead birds became irregular patches of shadow once again. No more than that. They were real, he thought again. The sparrows were real. That blind, revolted horror returned, making him feel somehow unclean. He tried to make his hands into fists, and his left responded with a wounded bellow. What little relief he had gotten from the Percodan was already passing. They were here. They were real. How can that be? He didn't know. Did I call them, or did I create them out of thin air? He didn't know that either. But he felt sure of one thing. The sparrows which had come tonight, the real sparrows which had come just before the trance had swallowed him, were only a fraction of all possible sparrows. Perhaps only a microscopic fraction. Never again, he thought. Please, never again. But he suspected that what he wanted did not matter. That was the real horror. He had touched some terrible paranormal talent in himself, but he could not control it. The very idea of control in this matter was a joke. And he believed that before this was over, they would be back. Thad shuddered and went back to the house. He slipped into his own pantry like a burglar, then locked the door behind him and took his throbbing hand up to bed. Before he went, he swallowed another Percodan, washing it down with water from the kitchen tap. Liz did not wake when he lay down beside her. Sometime later, he escaped into 3 hours of grainy, fitful sleep, in which nightmares flew and circled around him, always just out of reach. Chapter 19 Stark Makes a Purchase 1 Waking up wasn't like waking up. When you came right down to it, he didn't think he had ever really been awake or asleep, at least in the way normal people use those words. In a way, it was as if he were always asleep and only moved from one dream to another. In that way, his life, what little of it he remembered, was like a nest of Chinese boxes that never ended, or like peering into an endless hall of mirrors. This dream was a nightmare. He came slowly out of sleep, knowing he hadn't really been asleep at all. Somehow, Thad Beaumont had managed to capture him for a little while, had managed to bend him to his will for a little while. Had he said things, revealed things, while Beaumont had been in control of him? He had a feeling he might have done, but he also felt quite sure Beaumont would not know how to interpret those things, or how to tell the important things he might have said from the things that didn't matter. He also came out of sleep to pain. He had rented a two-room efficiency in the East Village, just off Avenue B. When he opened his eyes, he was sitting at the lopsided kitchen table with an open notebook in front of him. A rivulet of bright blood ran across the faded oilcloth which covered the table, and there was nothing very surprising about that, because there was a Bic pen sticking out of the back of his right hand. Now the dream began to come back. That was how he had been able to drive Beaumont out of his mind, the only way he had been able to break the bond the cowardly shit had somehow forged between them. Cowardly? Yes, but he was also sly, and it would be a bad idea to forget that. A very bad idea indeed. Stark could vaguely remember dreaming that Thad was with him, in his bed. They were talking together, whispering together, and at first this had seemed both pleasant and oddly comforting, like talking with your brother after lights out. Except they were doing more than talking, weren't they? What they had been doing was exchanging secrets. Or rather, Thad was asking him questions, and Stark found himself answering. It was pleasant to answer, it was comforting to answer, but it was also alarming. At first his alarm was centered on the birds. Why did Thad keep asking him about birds? There were no birds. Once, perhaps, a long, long time ago, but not anymore. It was just a mind game, a puny effort to freak him out. Then, little by little, his sense of alarm became entwined with his almost exquisitely attuned survival instinct. It grew sharper and more specific as he continued trying to struggle awake. He felt as if he were being held under water, drowned. So, still in that half-waking, half-dreaming state, he had gone into the kitchen, opened the notebook, and picked up the ballpoint pen. Thad hadn't tipped to any of that. Why should he have? Wasn't he also writing 500 miles away? The pen wasn't right, of course, didn't even feel right in his hand, but it would do, for now. Falling apart, he had watched himself write, and by then he had been very close to the magic mirror that divided sleep from wakefulness, and he struggled to impose his own thoughts upon the pen, his own will upon what would and would not appear on the blankness of the paper. But it was hard. Good God, good Christ, it was so damned hard. He had bought the Bic pen and half a dozen notebooks in a stationery shop right after he had arrived in New York City. Had done it even before renting the wretched Efficiency. There were barrel pencils in the shop, and he had wanted to buy them, but he hadn't. Because no matter whose mind it was that had driven the pencils, it had been Thad Beaumont's hand which held them, and he needed to know if that was a bond he could break. So he had left the pencils and had taken the pen instead. If he could write, if he could write on his own, all would be well and he wouldn't need the wretched whining creature up in Maine at all. But the pen had been useless to him. No matter how hard he tried, no matter how mightily he concentrated, the only thing he had been able to write was his own name. He had written it over and over again. George Stark, George Stark, George Stark, until at the bottom of the sheet they were not recognizable words at all, but only the jittery scribbles of a preschooler. Yesterday he had gone to a branch of the New York Public Library and had rented an hour's time on one of the grim gray electric IBMs in the writing room. The hour had seemed to last 1,000 years. He sat in a carrel which was enclosed on 3 sides, fingers trembling on the keys, and typed his name, this time in capital letters, George Stark, George Stark, George Stark. Break it, he had screamed at himself. Type something else, anything else, just break it. So he had tried. He had bent over the keys, sweating, and typed, "The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog." Only when he looked up at the paper, he saw that what he had written was, "The George Stark, George Starked over the Starky Stark." He had felt an urge to rip the IBM right off its bolts and go rampaging through the room with it, swinging the typewriter like a barbarian's mace, splitting heads and breaking backs. If he could not create, let him uncreate. Instead, he had controlled himself, with a mighty effort, and had walked out of the library, crumpling the useless sheet of paper in one strong hand as he went, and dropping it into a litter basket on the sidewalk. He remembered now, with the Bic pen in his hand, the utter blind rage he had felt at discovering that without Beaumont, he couldn't write anything but his own name. And the fear. The panic. But he still had Beaumont, didn't he? Beaumont might think it was the other way around, but maybe Beaumont was in for one large fucking surprise. "Losing," he wrote. And Jesus, he couldn't tell Beaumont any more. What he had written already was bad enough. He made a mighty effort to seize control of his traitor hand, to wake up. "Necessary cohesion," his hand wrote, as if to amplify the previous thought, and suddenly Stark saw himself stabbing Beaumont with the pen. He thought, "And I can do it, too. I don't think you could, Thad, because when it comes down to it, you're just a long drink of milk, aren't you? But when it comes to the sticking point, I can handle it, you bastard. It's time you learned that, I think." Then, even though this was like a dream within a dream, even though he was gripped by that horrible, vertiginous feeling of being out of control, some of his savage and unquestioning self-confidence returned, and he was able to pierce the shield of sleep. In that triumphant moment of breaking the surface, before Beaumont could drown him, he seized control of the pen, and was finally able to write with it. For a moment, and it was only a moment, there was a sensation of 2 hands grasping 2 writing instruments. The feeling was too clear, too real, to be anything but real. "There are no birds," he wrote. The first real sentence he had ever written as a physical being. It was terribly hard to write. Only a creature of supernatural determination could have suffered through the effort. But once the words were out, he felt his control strengthen. The grip of that other hand weakened, and Stark laid his own grip over it, showing no mercy or hesitation. "Drown for a while," he thought. "See how you like it." In a rush quicker and far more satisfying than even the most powerful orgasm, he wrote, "There are no fucking birds. Oh, you son of a bitch, get out of my head." Then before he could think about it, thinking might have provoked fatal hesitation, he swept the Bic pen around in a short, shallow arc. The steel tip plunged into his right hand, and hundreds of miles north, he could feel Thad Beaumont sweeping a barrel Black Beauty pencil around and plunging it into his left hand. That was when he woke up. When they both woke up. For real. 2. The pain was sizzling and enormous, but it was also liberating. Stark screamed, turning his sweaty head against his arm to muffle the sound, but it was a scream of joy and exhilaration as well as pain. He could feel Beaumont stifling his own scream in his study up there in Maine. The awareness Beaumont had created between them did not break. It was more like a hastily tied knot, which gave way under the pressure of a final tremendous yank. Stark sensed, almost saw, the probe the treacherous bastard had sent wriggling into his head while he slept, now twisting and twitching and slithering away. Stark reached out, not physically, but with his mind, and seized that disappearing tail of Thad's mental probe. In the eye of Stark's own mind, it looked like a worm, a fat white maggot deliriously stuffed with offal and decay. He thought of making Thad grab another pencil from the mason jar and use it to stab himself again, in the eye this time, or perhaps he would have him drive the pencil's point deep into his ear, rupturing the eardrum and digging for the soft meat of the brain beyond. He could almost hear Thad scream. He would not be able to muffle that one. Then he stopped. He didn't want Beaumont dead. At least not yet. Not until Beaumont had taught him how to live on his own. Stark slowly relaxed his fist, and as he did, he felt the fist in which he held Beaumont's essence, the mental fist, which had proved every bit as quick and merciless as his physical one, also open. He felt Beaumont, the plump white maggot, slip away, squealing and moaning. "Only for now," he whispered, and turned to the other necessary business. He closed his left hand around the pen jutting out of his right hand. He drew it smoothly out, then he dropped it into the wastebasket. 3. There was a bottle of Glenlivet standing on the stainless steel dish drainer by the sink. Stark picked it up and walked into the bathroom. His right hand swung by his side as he walked, splattering dime-sized droplets of blood on the warped and faded linoleum. The hole in his hand was about half an inch above the ridge of the knuckles and slightly to the right of the third one. It was perfectly round. The stain of the black ink around the edge of the hole, combined with the internal bleeding and trauma, made it look like a gunshot wound. He tried to flex the hand. The fingers moved, but the sickening wave of pain that resulted was too great for further experimentation. He pulled the chain depending from the fixture above the medicine cabinet mirror, and the unshaded 60-watt bulb came on. He used his right arm to hold the bottle of whiskey clamped against his side so he could unscrew the cap. Then he held his wounded hand splayed out over the basin. Was Beaumont doing the same thing in Maine? He doubted it. He doubted if Beaumont had the guts to clean up his own mess. He would undoubtedly be on his way to the hospital by now. Stark tipped whiskey into the wound, and a bolt of pure steely pain leaped up his arm to his shoulder. He saw the whiskey bubbling in the wound, saw little threads of blood in the amber, and had to bury his face against the sweat-soaked arm of his shirt again. He thought the pain would never fade, but at last it began to. He tried to put the bottle of whiskey on the shelf, bolted to the tile wall below the mirror. His hand was shaking too badly for this operation to stand much chance of success, so he set it on the rust-splotched tin floor of the shower stall instead. He would want a drink in a minute. He raised the hand to the light and peered into the hole. He could see the bulb through it, but dimly it was like looking through a red filter bleared with some kind of membranous muck. He hadn't driven the pen all the way through his hand, but it had been damned close. Maybe Beaumont had done better. He could always hope. He held his hand under the cold water tap, splaying the fingers to draw the hole as wide open as possible, then steeled himself for the pain. It was bad at first. He had to strain another scream through teeth which were clenched and lips which were pressed together in a thin white line. But then the hand grew numb and it was better. He forced himself to hold it under the tap for a full 3 minutes. Then he turned the faucet off and held it up to the light again. The glow of the bulb through the hole was still there, but now it was dim and distant. The wound was closing up. His body seemed to have amazing powers of regeneration, and that was rather amusing, because at the same time he was falling apart. Losing cohesion, he had written, and that was close enough. He looked at his face fixedly in the wavery spotted mirror on the medicine chest for 30 seconds or more, then shook himself back to awareness with a physical jerk. Looking at his face, so well known and familiar, and yet so new and strange, always made him feel as if he were falling into a hypnotic trance. He supposed if he looked at it long enough, he would do just that. Stark opened the medicine cabinet, swinging the mirror and his repulsively fascinating face aside. There was an odd little collection of items in the chest. 2 disposable razors, 1 used, bottles of makeup, a compact, several wedges of fine-grained sponge, ivory-colored where they had not been stained, a slightly darker color by face powder, a bottle of generic aspirin. No band-aids. Band-aids were like cops, he thought. Never went around when you really needed one. That was all right, though. He would disinfect the wound with some more whiskey, after disinfecting his insides with a healthy wallop, that was, and then wrap it in a handkerchief. He didn't think it would turn septic. He seemed immune to infection. He also found this amusing. He used his teeth to uncap the aspirin bottle, spat the cap into the basin, then upended the bottle and shook 6 pills into his mouth. He took the whiskey out of the shower stall and washed the aspirins down with a slug. The booze hit his stomach and opened its comforting blossom of heat there. Then he used some more on his hand. Stark went into the bedroom and opened the top drawer of a bureau which had seen better, much better, days. It and an ancient sofa bed were the only pieces of furniture in the room. The top drawer was the only one with anything in it save newspaper liners from the Daily News. 3 pairs of undershorts, still in the store wrapper, 2 pairs of socks with the manufacturer's label still banded around them, 1 pair of Levi's, and a Have a Hank, also still in its wrapper. He tore the cellophane open with his teeth and tied the Have a Hank around his hand. Amber whiskey soaked through the thin cloth, then 1 small bloom of blood. Stark waited to see if the bloom would spread, but it didn't. Good deal. A very good deal. Had Beaumont been able to pick up any sensory input, he wondered? Did he maybe know that George Stark was currently sheltering in a cruddy little East Village apartment in a cheesy building where the roaches looked big enough to steal the welfare checks? He didn't think so, but it made no sense to take chances when he didn't have to. He had promised Thad a week to decide, and although he was now all but positive that Thad had no plans to start writing as Stark again, he would see that Thad got all the time he had been promised. He was a man of his word, after all. Beaumont was probably going to need a little inspiration. One of those little propane torches you could buy in hardware stores, turned on the soles of his kid's feet for a couple of seconds, ought to do the trick, Stark thought. But that was for later. For the time being, he would play a waiting game, and while he did, it wouldn't hurt to start drifting north. To get a little field position, you might say. There was, after all, his car, the Black Toronado. It was in storage, but that didn't mean it had to stay in storage. He could leave New York City tomorrow morning. But before he did, he had a purchase to make. And right now he ought to use some of the cosmetics in the bathroom cabinet. 4. He took out the little jars of liquid makeup, the powder, the sponges. He took another hefty drink from the bottle before starting. His hands were steady again, but his right throbbed nastily. This did not particularly upset him. If his was throbbing, Beaumont's must be screening. He faced himself in the mirror, touched the arc of skin under his left eye with his left finger, then ran it down his cheek to the corner of his mouth. "Losing cohesion," he muttered. And oh boy, that certainly was the truth. When Stark had first looked at his face, kneeling outside Homeland Cemetery, gazing into a mud puddle whose still and scummy surface had been lit by the round white moon of a nearby street lamp, he had been satisfied. It was exactly as it had appeared in the dreams he'd had while imprisoned in the womb-like dungeon of Beaumont's imagination. He had seen a conventionally handsome man whose features were a little too broad to attract much attention. Had the forehead not been quite so high, the eyes not so far apart, it might have been the sort of face that would make women turn their heads for a second look. A perfectly nondescript face, if there is such a thing, may attract attention just because there is no one feature to catch the eye before the eye dismisses it and moves on. Its utter ordinariness may trouble that eye and cause it to return for a second glance. The face Stark had seen for the first time with real eyes in the mud puddle missed that degree of plainness by a comfortable margin. He had thought it the perfect face, one no one would be able to describe afterward. Blue eyes, a tan that might seem the tiniest bit odd on one with such fair hair, and that was it. That was all. The witness would be forced to move on to the broad shoulders, which were really the most distinguishing thing about him, and the world was full of broad-shouldered men. Now everything had changed. Now his face had become decidedly strange. And if he did not begin writing again soon, it would become more than strange. It would become grotesque. Losing cohesion, he thought again. But you're going to put a stop to that, Thad. When you start the book about the armored car job, what's happening to me will start to reverse itself. I don't know how I know that, but I do know it. It had been 2 weeks since he had seen himself for the first time in that puddle, and his face had undergone a steady degeneration since then. It had been subtle at first, so subtle that he had been able to persuade himself it was only his imagination. But as the changes began to speed up, that position had become untenable, and he had been forced to retreat from it. Seeing a photograph of him taken then and one taken now might have made someone think of a man who had been exposed to some weird radiation or corrosive chemical substance. George Stark seemed to be experiencing a spontaneous breakdown of all his soft tissues at the same time. The crow's feet around the eyes, ordinary marks of middle age which he had seen in the puddle, were now deep grooves. His lids had grown droopy and had taken on the rough texture of crocodile skin. His cheeks had begun to take on a similar seamed and cracked look. The rims of the eyes themselves had grown reddish, giving him the sorrowful look of a man who didn't know it was time to take his nose out of the bottle. Deep lines had carved themselves in the flesh of his face from the corners of his lips to the line of his jaw, giving his mouth the disquietingly hinged look of a ventriloquist dummy. His blonde hair, fine to begin with, had grown finer still, drawing back from his temples and showing the pink skin of his pate. Liver spots had appeared on the backs of his hands. He could have abided all this without resorting to makeup. He only looked old, after all, and old age was hardly remarkable. His strength seemed unimpaired. Plus, there was that unshakable surety that once he and Beaumont started writing again, writing as George Stark, that was, the process would reverse itself. But now his teeth had grown loose in his gums, and there were sores, too. He had noticed the first one inside his right elbow 3 days ago, a red patch with a lace of dead white skin around the edges. It was the sort of blemish he associated with pellagra, which had been endemic in the Deep South even into the 1960s. The day before yesterday he had seen another one, on his neck this time, below the lobe of his left ear. Two more yesterday, one on his chest between his nipples, the other below his navel. Today, the first one had appeared on his face, at the right temple. They didn't hurt. There was a dull, deep-seated itch, but that was all. At least as far as sensation went. But they spread rapidly. His right arm was now a dull, swollen red from the fold of his elbow halfway to his shoulder. He had made the mistake of scratching, and the flesh had given way with sickening ease. A mixture of blood and yellowish pus had oozed out along the trenches his fingernails had left, and the wounds gave off a ghastly, gassy smell. Yet it was not infection. He would have sworn to that. It was more like damp rot. Looking at him now, someone, even a trained medical person, would probably have guessed grass fire melanoma, perhaps caused by exposure to high-level radiation. Still, the sores did not worry him greatly. He supposed they would multiply in number, spread in area, join each other, and eventually eat him alive, if he let them. Since he didn't intend to let that happen, there was no need for them to worry him. But he couldn't be just another face in the crowd if the features on that face were transforming themselves into an erupting volcano. Hence, the makeup. He applied the liquid foundation carefully with one of the sponge wedges, spreading it up from cheekbones to temples, eventually covering the dull red lump beyond the end of his right brow and the new sore just beginning to poke through the skin over his left cheekbone. A man wearing pancake makeup looked like only one thing on God's earth, Stark had discovered, and that was a man wearing pancake makeup. Which was to say, either an actor in a TV soap opera or a guest on the Donahue Show. But anything was an improvement on the sores, and the tan mitigated some of the phony effect. If he stayed in the gloom or was seen in artificial lighting, it was hardly noticeable at all. Or so he hoped. There were other reasons to stay out of direct sunlight as well. He suspected the sun actually accelerated the disastrous chemical reaction going on inside him. It was almost as if he were turning into a vampire. But that was all right. In a way, he had always been one. Besides, I'm a night person, always have been. That's just my nature. This made him grin, and the grin exposed teeth like fangs. He screwed the cover back on the liquid makeup and began to powder. I can smell myself, he thought, and pretty soon other people are going to be able to smell me too. A thick, unpleasant smell, like a can of potted meat that spent the day standing in the sun. This is not good, friends and dear hearts. This is not good at all. You will write, Fad, he said, looking at himself in the mirror. But with luck, you won't have to do it for long. He grinned more widely, exposing an incisor which had gone dark and dead. I'm a quick study. 5. At 10:30 the next day, a stationer on Houston Street sold 3 boxes of Barrel Black Beauty pencils to a tall, broad-shouldered man wearing a checked shirt, blue jeans, and very large sunglasses. The man was also wearing pancake makeup, the stationer observed, probably the remains of a night spent tomcatting around in the leather bars. And from the way he smelled, the stationer thought he had done a little more than just splash on the old English leather. He smelled as if he had bathed in it. The cologne didn't disguise the fact that the broad-shouldered dude smelled filthy. The stationer thought briefly, very briefly, about making a wisecrack, and then thought again. The dude smelled bad, but looked strong. Also, the transaction was mercifully brief. After all, it was just pencils the fruitcake was buying, not a Rolls-Royce Corniche. Best to leave ill enough alone. 6. Stark made a brief stop back at the East Village Efficiency to stuff his few belongings into the pack sack he had bought in an Army-Navy store on his first day in the maggoty old Big Apple. If not for the bottle of scotch, he probably would not have bothered to return at all. On his way up the crumbling front steps, he passed the small bodies of 3 dead sparrows without noticing them. He left Avenue B on foot, but he didn't walk for long. A determined man, he had discovered, can always find a ride if he really needs one. Chapter 20 Over the Deadline 1 The day Thad Beaumont's week of grace ended felt more like a day in late July than one in the third week of June. Thad drove the 18 miles to the University of Maine under a sky the color of hazy chrome, the air conditioner in the Suburban going full blast in spite of the havoc it wreaked on the gas mileage. There was a dark brown Plymouth behind him. It never got closer than 2 car lengths and never dropped back farther than 5. It rarely allowed another car to come between itself and Thad's Suburban. If one did happen to ease its way into the 2-car parade at an intersection or the school zone in Vesey, the brown Plymouth passed quickly. And if this didn't look almost immediately feasible, one of Thad's guardians would pull the cover off the blue bubble on the dashboard. A few flashes from that would do the trick. Thad drove mostly with his right hand, using his left only when he absolutely had to. The hand was better now, but it still hurt like hell if he bent or flexed it too ruthlessly. And he found himself counting down the last few minutes of the last hour before he could swallow another Percodan. Liz hadn't wanted him to go up to the university today, and the state police assigned to the Beaumonts hadn't wanted him to either. For the state boys, the issue was simple. They hadn't wanted to split their watch team. With Liz, things were a little more complex. What she talked about was his hand. He might open the wound trying to drive, she said. What was in her eyes was quite different. Her eyes had been full of George Stark.
Just what in the hell do you have to go up to the shop for today, anyway? She had wanted to know.
And this was a question he had had to prepare himself for, because the semester was over, had been for some time now, and he wasn't teaching any summer classes. What he'd settled on, finally, were the honors folders. 60 students had applied for EH-7A, the department's honors course in creative writing. This was over twice the number that had applied for the previous fall semester's honors writing course, but, elementary, my dear Watson, last fall the world, including that part of it majoring in English at the University of Maine, had not known that boring old Thad Beaumont also just happened to be funky George Stark. So he had told Liz that he wanted to pull those files and start going through them, winnowing the 60 applicants down to 15 students, the maximum he could take on, and probably 14 more than he could actually teach, in a creative writing course. She had, of course, wanted to know why he couldn't put it off, at least until July, and had reminded him, also, of course, that he had put it off until mid-August the year before. He had gone back to the big leap in applications, then added virtuously that he didn't want last summer's laziness to become a habit. At last she had stopped protesting, not because his arguments had convinced her, he thought, but because she could see he meant to go no matter what. And she knew as well as he did that they would have to start going out again sooner or later. Hiding in the house until someone killed or collared George Stark wasn't a very palatable option. But her eyes had still been full of a dull, questioning fear. Thad had kissed her and the twins and left quickly. She looked as if she might start crying soon, and if he was still home when she did that, he would stay home. It wasn't the honors folders, of course. It was the deadline. He had awakened this morning full of his own dull fear, a feeling as unpleasant as a belly cramp. George Stark had called on the evening of June 10th and had given him a week to get going on the novel about the armored car heist. Thad had still done nothing about starting, although he saw how the book could go more clearly with each passing day. He had even dreamed about it a couple of times. It made a nice break from touring his own deserted house in his sleep and having things explode when he touched them. But this morning, his first thought had been, the deadline. I'm over the deadline. That meant it was time to talk to George again, as little as he wanted to do that. It was time to find out just how angry George was. Well, he supposed he knew the answer to that one. But it was just possible that, if he was very angry, out of control angry, and if Thad could goad him until he was all the way out of control, foxy old George might just make a mistake and let something slip. Losing cohesion. Thad had a feeling that George had already let something slip when he allowed Thad's intruding hand to write those words in his journal. If he could only be sure of what they meant, that was. He had an idea, but he wasn't sure. And a mistake at this point could mean more than just his life. So he was on his way to the university, on his way to his office in the English math building. He was on his way there not to collect the honors files, although he would, but because there was a telephone there, one that wasn't tapped, and because something had to be done. He was over the deadline. Glancing down at his left hand, which rested on the steering wheel, he thought, not for the first time during this long, long week, that the telephone was not the only way to get in touch with George. He had proved that, but the price had been very high. It was not just the excruciating agony of plunging a sharpened pencil into the back of his hand, or the horror of watching while his out-of-control body hurt itself at the command of Stark, foxy old George, who seemed to be the ghost of a man who had never been. He had paid the real price in his mind. The real price had been the coming of the Sparrows. The terror of realizing that the forces at work here were much greater and even more incomprehensible than George Stark himself. The Sparrows, he had become more and more sure, meant death. But for whom? He was terrified that he might have to risk the Sparrows in order to get in touch with George Stark again. And he could see them coming. He could see them arriving at that mystic halfway point where the two of them were linked, that place where he would eventually have to wrestle George Stark for control of the one soul they shared. He was afraid he knew who would win in a struggle at that place. 2. Alan Pangborn sat in his office at the rear of the Castle County Sheriff's Office, which occupied one wing of the Castle Rock Municipal Building. It had been a long, stressful week for him, too, but that was nothing new. Once summer really started to roll in the Rock, it got this way. Law enforcement from Memorial Day to Labor Day was always insane in vacation land. There had been a gaudy four-car smash-up on Route 117 5 days ago, a booze-inspired wreck that had left two people dead. 2 days later, Norton Briggs had hit his wife with a frying pan, knocking her flat on the kitchen floor. Norton had hit his wife a great many licks during the turbulent 20 years of their marriage, but this time he apparently believed he had killed her. He wrote a brief note, long on remorse and short on grammar, then took his own life with a .38 revolver. When his wife, no Rhodes Scholar herself, woke up and found the cooling corpse of her tormentor lying beside her, she had turned on the gas oven and stuck her head into it. The paramedics from rescue services in Oxford had saved her. Barely. Two kids from New York had wandered away from their parents' cottage on Castle Lake and had gotten lost in the woods, just like Hansel and Gretel. They had been found 8 hours later, scared but all right. John LaPointe, Allen's number two deputy, was not in such good shape. He was home with a raving case of poison ivy he had contracted during the search. There had been a fist fight between two summer people over the last copy of the Sunday New York Times at Nan's Luncheonette. Another fist fight in the parking lot of the Mellow Tiger. A weekend fisherman had torn off half of his right ear while trying to make a fancy cast into the lake. Three cases of shoplifting and a small dope bust at Universe, Castle Rock's billiard parlor and video game arcade. Just your typical small-town week in June, a sort of grand opening celebration for summer. Alan had had barely enough time to drink a whole cup of coffee at one sitting, and still he had found his mind turning to Thad and Liz Beaumont again and again. To them and to the man who was haunting them. That man had also killed Homer Gamache. Alan had made several calls to the New York City cops. There was a certain Lieutenant Reardon who was probably very sick of him by now. But they had nothing new to report. Alan had come in this afternoon to an unexpectedly peaceful office. Sheila Brigham had nothing to report from dispatch, and Norris Ridgwick was snoozing in his chair out in the bullpen area, feet cocked up on his desk. Alan should have wakened him. If Danforth Keaton, the first selectman, came in and saw Norris cooping like that, he would have a cow. But he just didn't have the heart to do it. It had been a busy week for Norris, too. Norris had been in charge of scraping up the road toads after the smash out on 117, and he had done a damned good job, fluttery stomach and all. Alan now sat behind his desk, making shadow animals in a patch of sun which fell upon the wall, and his thoughts turned once more to Thad Beaumont. After getting Thad's blessing, Dr. Hume in Orono had called Alan to tell him that Thad's neurological tests were negative. Thinking of this now, Alan's mind turned once more to Dr. Hugh Pritchard, who had operated on Thad when Thaddeus Beaumont was 11 and a long way from famous. A rabbit hopped across the patch of sun on the wall. It was followed by a cat. A dog chased the cat. "Leave it alone. It's crazy." Sure, it was crazy. And sure, he could leave it alone. There would be another crisis to handle here before long. You didn't have to be psychic to know that. It was just the way things went during the summer here in the Rock. You were kept so busy that most times you couldn't think, and sometimes it was good not to think. An elephant followed the dog, swinging a shadow trunk, which was actually Alan Pangborn's left forefinger. "Ah, fuck it," he said, and pulled the telephone over to him. At the same time, his other hand was digging his wallet out of his back pocket. He punched the button which automatically dialed the state police barracks in Oxford and asked dispatch there if Henry Payton, Oxford's OC and CID man, was in. It turned out he was. Alan had time to think that the state police must also be having a slow day for a change, and then Henry was on the line. "Alan, what can I do for you?" "I was wondering," Alan said, "if you'd like to call the head ranger at Yellowstone National Park for me. I could give you the number." He looked at it with mild surprise. He had gotten it from directory assistance almost a whole week before and written it on the back of a business card. His facile hands had dug it out of his wallet almost on their own. "Yellowstone?" Henry sounded amused. "Isn't that where Yogi Bear hangs out?" "Nope," Alan said, smiling. "That's Jellystone, and the bear isn't suspected of anything anyway.
At least as far as I know. I need to talk to a man who's on a camping vacation there, Henry. Well, I don't know if I actually need to talk to him or not, but it would set my mind at rest. It feels like unfinished business. Does it have to do with Homer Gamache?
Alan shifted the phone to his other ear and walked the business card on which he had written the Yellowstone Head Ranger's number absently across his knuckles.
Yes, he said, but if you ask me to explain, I'm going to sound like a fool.
Just a hunch?
Yes.
And he was surprised to find he did have a hunch. He just wasn't sure what it was about.
The man I want to talk to is a retired doctor named Hugh Pritchard. He's with his wife. The head ranger probably knows where they are. I understand you have to register when you come in. And I'm guessing it's probably in a camping area with access to a telephone. They're both in their 70s. If you called the head ranger, he'd probably pass the message on to the guy.
In other words, you think a national park ranger might take the officer commanding of a state police troop more seriously than a dipshit county sheriff?
You have a very diplomatic way of putting things, Henry.
Henry Peyton laughed delightedly. I do, don't I? Well, I'll tell you what, Alan, I don't mind doing a little business for you as long as you don't want me to wade in any deeper. And as long as you...
No, this is it, Alan said gratefully. This is all I want.
Wait a minute, I'm not done. As long as you understand, I can't use our watch line here to make the call. The captain looks at those statements, my friend. He looks very closely. And if he saw this one, I think he might want to know why I was spending the taxpayers' money to stir your stew. You see what I'm saying?
Alan sighed resignedly. You can use my personal credit card number, he said. And you can tell the head ranger to have Pritchard call collect. I'll redline the call and pay for it out of my own pocket.
There was a pause on the other end, and when Henry spoke again, he was more serious.
This really means something to you, doesn't it, Alan?
Yes. I don't know why, but it does.
There was a second pause. Alan could feel Henry Peyton struggling not to ask questions. At last, Henry's better nature won. Or perhaps, Alan thought, it was only his more practical nature.
Okay, he said. I'll make the call and tell the head ranger that you want to talk to this Hugh Pritchard about an ongoing murder investigation in Castle County, Maine. What's his wife's name?
Helga.
Where are they from?
Fort Laramie, Wyoming.
Okay, Sheriff. Here comes the hard part. What's your telephone credit card number?
Sighing, Alan gave it to him. A minute later, he had the shadow parade marching across the patch of sunlight on the wall again.
The guy will probably never call back, he thought. And if he does, he won't be able to tell me a goddamn thing I can use. How could he?
Still, Henry had been right about one thing. He had a hunch. About something. And it wasn't going away. 3. While Alan Pangborn was speaking to Henry Peyton, Thad Beaumont was parking in one of the faculty slots behind the English math building. He got out, being careful not to bang his left hand. For a moment he just stood there, digging the day and the unaccustomed dozy peace of the campus. The brown Plymouth pulled in next to his Suburban, and the two big men who got out dispelled any dream of peace he might have been on the verge of building.
I'm just going up to my office for a few minutes, Thad said. You could stay down here if you wanted.
He eyed two girls strolling by, probably on their way to East Annex to sign up for summer courses. One was wearing a halter top and blue shorts, the other an almost non-existent mini with no back and a hem that was a strong man's heartbeat away from the swell of her buttocks.
Enjoy the scenery.
The two state cops had turned to follow the girls' progress as if their heads were mounted on invisible swivels. Now the one in charge, Ray Garrison or Roy Harriman, Thad wasn't sure which, turned back and said regretfully,
"Sure would like to, sir, but we better come up with you."
"Really, it's just the second floor.
We'll wait out in the hall."
"You guys don't know how much all of this is starting to depress me," Thad said.
"Orders," Garrison or Harriman said.
It was clear that Thad's depression, or happiness for that matter, meant less than zero to him.
"Yeah," Thad said, giving it up. "Orders."
He headed for the side door. The two cops followed him at a distance of a dozen paces, looking more like cops in their street clothes than they ever had in their uniforms, Thad suspected. After the still humid heat, the air conditioning struck Thad with a wallop. All at once, his shirt felt as if it were freezing to his skin. The building, so full of life and racket during the September to May academic year, felt a little creepy on this weekend afternoon at the end of spring. It would fill up maybe a third of its usual hustle and bustle on Monday, when the first three-week summer session started. But for today, Thad found himself feeling a trifle relieved to have his police guard with him. He thought the second floor, where his office was, might be entirely deserted, which would at least allow him to avoid the necessity of explaining his large, watchful friends. It turned out not to be entirely deserted, but he got off easily just the same. Raleigh de Lesseps was wandering down the hallway from the department common room toward his own office, drifting in his usual Raleigh de Lesseps way, which meant he looked as if he might have recently sustained a hard blow to the head which had disrupted both his memory and his motor control. He moved dreamily from one side of the corridor to the other in mild loops, peering at the cartoons, poems, and announcements tacked to the bulletin boards on the locked doors of his colleagues. He might have been on his way to his office. It looked that way. But even someone who knew him well would probably have declined to make book on it. The stem of an enormous yellow pipe was clamped between his dentures. The dentures were not quite as yellow as the pipe, but they were close. The pipe was dead, had been since late 1985, when his doctor had forbidden him to smoke it following a mild heart attack. "I never liked to smoke that much anyway," Raleigh would explain in his gentle, distracted voice when someone asked him about the pipe. "But without the bit in my teeth, gentlemen, I would not know where to go or what to do if I were lucky enough to arrive there." Most times he gave the impression of not knowing where to go or what to do anyway, as he did now. Some people knew Raleigh for years before discovering he was not at all the absent-minded, educated fool he seemed to be. Some never discovered it at all. "Hello, Raleigh," Thad said, picking through his keys. Raleigh blinked at him, shifted his gaze to scan the two men behind Thad, dismissed them, and returned his gaze to Thad once more. "Hello, Thaddeus," he said. "I didn't think you were teaching any summer courses this year."
"I'm not."
"Then what can have possessed you to come here, of all places, on the first bona fide dog day of summer?"
"Just picking up some honors files," Thad said. "I'm not going to be here any longer than I have to, believe me."
"What did you do to your hand? It's black and blue all the way to the wrist."
"Well," Thad said, looking embarrassed. The story made him sound like a drunk or an idiot, or both, but it still went down a lot easier than the truth would have done. Thad had been dourly amused to find that the police accepted it as easily as Raleigh did now. There had not been a single question about how or why he had managed to slam his own hand in the door of his bedroom closet. He had instinctively known exactly the right story to tell. Even in his agony, he had known that. He was expected to do clumsy things. It was part of his character. In a way, it was like telling the interviewer from People, God rest his soul, that George Stark had been created in Ludlow instead of Castle Rock, and that the reason Stark wrote in longhand was because he had never learned to type. He hadn't even tried to lie to Liz, but he had insisted she keep quiet about what had really happened, and she had agreed to do so. Her only concern had been extracting a promise from him that he would not try to contact Stark again. He had given the promise willingly enough, although he knew it was one he might not be able to keep. He suspected that, on some deep level of her mind, Liz knew that too. Raleigh was now looking at him with real interest.
"In a closet door," he said. "Marvelous. Were you perhaps playing hide-and-seek, or was it some strange sexual rite?"
Thad grinned.
"I gave up strange sexual rites around 1981, he said. "Doctor's advice. Actually, I just wasn't paying attention to what I was doing. The whole thing is sort of embarrassing."
"I imagine so," Raleigh said, and then winked. It was a very subtle wink, a bare flutter of one puffed and wrinkled old eyelid, but it was very definitely there. Had he thought he had fooled Raleigh? Pigs might fly. Suddenly a new thought occurred to Thad.
"Raleigh, do you still teach that folk myth seminar?"
"Every fall," Raleigh agreed.
"Don't you read your own department's catalog, Thaddeus? Dowsing, witches, holistic remedies, hex signs of the rich and famous. It's as popular now as ever. Why do you ask?"
There was an all-purpose answer to that question, Thad had discovered,
One of the best things about being a writer was that you always had an answer to, "Why do you ask?" "Well, I have a story idea," he said. "It's still in the exploration stage, but it's got possibilities, I think." "What did you want to know?" "Do sparrows have any significance in American superstition or folk myth that you know of?" Raleigh's furrowing brow began to resemble the topography of some alien planet which was clearly inimical to human life. He gnawed on the stem of his pipe. "Nothing occurs right off the top of my head, Thaddeus, although I wonder if that's really why you're interested." "Pigs might fly," Thad thought again. "Well, maybe not, Raleigh, maybe not. Maybe I just said that because my interest is nothing I could explain in a hurry." His eyes flicked briefly to his watchdogs, then returned to Raleigh's face. "I'm a bit pressed for time right now." Raleigh's lips quivered in the faintest ghost of a smile. "I understand, I think. Sparrows, such common birds. Too common to have any deep superstitious connotations, I'd think. Yet, now that I think about it, there is something. Except I associate it with whippoorwills. Let me check. Will you be here a while?"
"Not more than half an hour, I'm afraid."
"Well, I might find something right away in Barringer's book, Folklore of America. It's really not much more than a cookbook of superstitions, but it comes in handy. And I could always call you." "Yes, you could always do that." "Lovely party you and Liz threw for Tom Carroll," Raleigh said. "Of course, you and Liz always throw the best parties. Your wife is much too charming to be a wife, Thaddeus. She should be your mistress."
"Thanks, I guess."
"Gonzo Tom," Raleigh continued fondly. "It's hard to believe Gonzo Tom Carroll has sailed into the gray havens of retirement. I've been listening to him cut those trumpet blast farts of his in the next office for better than 20 years. I suppose the next fellow will be quieter, or at least more discreet." Thad laughed. "Wilhelmina also enjoyed herself," Raleigh said. His eyelids drooped roguishly. He knew perfectly well how Thad and Liz felt about Billy. "That's fine," Thad said. He found Billy Burks and the concept of enjoyment mutually exclusive. But since she and Raleigh had formed part of a badly needed alibi, he supposed he should be glad she had come. "And if anything occurs to you about that other thing..." "Sparrows and their place in the invisible world, yes, indeed." Raleigh nodded to the two policemen behind Thad. "Good afternoon, gentlemen." He skirted them and continued on down to his office with a little more purpose. Not much, but a little. Thad looked after him, bemused. "What was that?" Garrison or Harriman asked. "Delesseps," Thad murmured, "chief grammarian and amateur folklorist." "Looks like the kind of guy who might need a map to find his way home," the other cop said. Thad moved to the door of his office and unlocked it. "He's more alert than he looks," he said, and opened the door. He wasn't aware that Garrison, or Harriman, was beside him, one hand inside his specially tailored tall fella sport coat, until he had flicked on the overhead lights. Thad felt a moment of belated fear, but the office was empty, of course. Empty and so neat, after the soft and steady fallout of an entire year's clutter, that it looked dead. For no reason that he could place, he felt a sudden and nearly sickening wave of homesickness and emptiness and loss, a mix of feelings like a deep, unexpected grief. It was like the dream. It was as if he had come here to say goodbye. "Stop being so goddamn foolish," he told himself, and another part of his mind replied quietly, "Over the deadline, Thad. You're over the deadline, and I think you might have made a very bad mistake in not at least trying to do what the man wants you to do. Short-term relief is better than no relief at all." "If you want coffee, you can get a cup in the common room," he said. "The pot will be full if I know Raleigh." "Where's that?" Garrison or Harriman's partner asked. "Other side of the hall, 2 doors up, Thad said, unlocking the files. He turned and gave them a grin that felt crooked on his face. "I think you'll hear me if I scream." "Just make sure you do yell if something happens," Garrison or Harriman said. "I will." "I could send Manchester here for the coffee," Garrison or Harriman said, "but I get the feeling that you're asking for a little privacy." "Well, yeah, now that you mention it." "That's fine, Mr. Beaumont," he said. He looked at Thad seriously,
and Thad suddenly remembered that his name was Harrison, just like the ex-Beatle. Stupid to have forgotten it.
You just want to remember those people in New York died from an overdose of privacy.
Oh, I thought Phyllis Myers and Rick Cowley died in the company of the police. He thought of saying this out loud and then didn't. These men were, after all, only trying to do their duty.
"Lighten up, Trooper Harrison," he said. "The building's so quiet today a barefoot man would make echoes."
"Okay. We'll be across the hall in the, what do you call it?
Common room."
"Right." They left, and Thad opened the file marked HNRS-APPS. In his mind's eye, he kept seeing Raleigh de Lesseps dropping that quick, unobtrusive wink, and listening to that voice telling him he was over the deadline, that he had crossed to the dark side, the side where the monsters were.
4.
The phone sat there and didn't ring. "Come on," he thought at it, stacking the honors folders on the desk beside his university-supplied IBM Selectric.
"Come on, come on. Here I am, standing right next to a phone with no bug on it. So come on, George. Give me a call. Give me a ring. Give me the scoop."
But the phone only sat there and didn't ring. He realized he was looking into a file cabinet that wasn't just pruned, but entirely empty. In his preoccupation, he had pulled all the folders, not just the ones belonging to honors students interested in taking creative writing. Even the Xeroxes of those who wanted to take transformational grammar, which was the gospel according to Noam Chomsky, translated by that dean of the dead pipe, Raleigh de Lesseps. Thad went to the door and looked out. Harrison and Manchester were standing in the door of the department common room, drinking coffee. In their ham-sized fists, the mugs looked the size of demitasse cups. Thad raised his hand, Harrison raised his in return, and asked him if he would be much longer.
5 minutes, Thad said, and both cops nodded.
He went back to his desk, separated the creative writing files from the others, and began to replace the latter in the file drawer, doing it as slowly as possible, giving the phone time to ring. But the phone just went on sitting there. He heard one ring someplace far down the corridor, the sound muffled by a closed door, somehow ghostly in the building's unaccustomed summer silence.
Maybe George got the wrong number, he thought, and uttered a little laugh.
The fact was, George wasn't going to call. The fact was, he, Thad, had been wrong. Apparently George had some other trick up his sleeve. Why should he be surprised? Tricks were George Stark's spécialité de la maison. Still, he had been so sure, so goddamn sure.
Thaddeus?
He jumped, almost spilling the contents of the last half a dozen files onto the floor. When he was sure they weren't going to slip out of his grasp, he turned around. Raleigh de Lesseps was standing just outside the door. His large pipe poked in like a horizontal periscope.
"Sorry," Thad said. "You threw a jump into me, Raleigh. My mind was 10,000 miles away." "Someone calling for you on my phone," Raleigh said amiably. "Must have gotten the wrong number. Lucky I was in."
Thad felt his heart begin to beat slow and hard. It was as if there were a snare drum inside his chest and someone had begun to whack it with a great deal of measured energy.
"Yes," Thad said. "That was very lucky."
Raleigh gave him an appraising glance. The blue eyes under his puffy, slightly reddened lids were so alive and inquisitive they were almost rude, and certainly at odds with his cheerful, bumbling, absent-minded professor manner.
"Is everything quite all right, Thaddeus?"
"No, Raleigh. These days there's a mad killer out there who's partly me, a fellow who can apparently take over my body and make me do fun things like sticking pencils into myself, and I consider each day which concludes with me still sane a victory. Reality is out of joint, good buddy."
"All right? Why wouldn't everything be all right?"
"I seem to detect the faint but unmistakably ferrous odor of irony, Thad."
"You're mistaken."
"Am I? Then why do you look like a deer caught in a pair of headlights?"
"Raleigh."
"And the man I just spoke to sounds like the sort of salesman you buy something from on the phone just to make sure he'll never visit your home in person."
"It's nothing, Raleigh."
"Very well." Raleigh didn't look convinced. Thad left his office and headed down the hall toward Raleigh's.
"Where are you off to?" Harrison called after him. Raleigh has a call for me in his office, he explained. The phone numbers up here are all sequential. The guy must have gotten the numbers bollocksed.
And just happened to get the only other faculty member here today? Harrison asked skeptically.
Thad shrugged and kept on walking. Raleigh DeLessop's office was cluttered, pleasant, and still inhabited by the smell of his pipe. 2 years' abstinence apparently did not make up for some 30 years of indulgence. It was dominated by a dartboard with a photograph of Ronald Reagan mounted on it, an encyclopedia-sized volume, Franklin Berringer's Folklore of America, lay open on Raleigh's desk. The telephone was off the hook, lying on a stack of blank blue books.
Looking at the handset, Thad felt the old dread fall over him in its familiar stifling folds. It was like being bundled in a blanket that badly needs to be washed. He turned his head, sure he would see all three of them, Raleigh, Harrison, and Manchester, lined up in the doorway like sparrows on a telephone wire. But the office doorway was empty, and from somewhere down the hall he could hear the soft rasp of Raleigh's voice. He had buttonholed Thad's guard dogs. Thad doubted that he had done it by accident. He picked up the telephone and said, "Hello, George."
"You've had your week,"
the voice on the other end said. It was Stark's voice, but Thad wondered if the voice prints would match so exactly now. Stark's voice wasn't the same. It had grown hoarse and rough, like the voice of a man who had spent too much time hollering at some sporting event.
"You had your week, and you haven't done doodly squat."
"Right you are," Thad said. He felt very cold. He had to expend a conscious effort to keep from shivering. That cold seemed to be coming out of the telephone itself, oozing out of the holes in the earpiece like icicles. But he was also very angry.
"I'm not going to do it, George. A week, a month, 10 years, it's all the same to me. Why not accept it? You're dead, and dead you will stay." "You're wrong, old hoss. If you want to be dead wrong, you'll just keep going."
"Do you know what you sound like, George?" Thad asked. "You sound like you're falling apart. That's why you want me to start writing again, isn't it? Losing cohesion, that's what you wrote. You're biodegrading, right? It won't be long before you just crumble to bits, like the wonderful one hoss Shay."
"None of that matters to you, Thad,"
the hoarse voice replied. It went from a scabrous drone to a harsh sound like gravel falling out of the back of a dump truck to a squeaking whisper, as if the vocal cords had given up functioning altogether for the space of a phrase or two, and then back to the drone again.
"None of what's going on with me is your concern. That's nothing but a distraction to you, buddy. You just want to get going by nightfall, or you're going to be one sorry son of a bitch, and you won't be the only one."
"I don't..." Click. Stark was gone. Thad looked at the telephone handset thoughtfully for a moment, then replaced it in the cradle. When he turned around, Harrison and Manchester were standing there. 5.
"Who was it?"
Manchester asked. "A student," Thad said. At this point, he wasn't even sure why he was lying. The only thing he was really sure of was that he had a terrible feeling in his guts.
"Just a student, as I thought." "How did he know you'd be in?" Harrison asked. "And how come he called on this gentleman's phone?"
"I give up," Thad said humbly.
"I'm a Russian deep cover agent. It was really my contact. I'll go quietly."
Harrison wasn't angry, or at least he did not appear to be angry. The look of slightly tired reproach he sent Thad's way was a good deal more effective than anger.
"Mr. Beaumont, we're trying to give you and your wife a help. I know that having a couple of fellows trail after you wherever you go can get to be a pain in the ass after a while, but we really are trying to give you a help."
Thad felt ashamed of himself, but not ashamed enough to tell the truth. That bad feeling was still there, the feeling that things were going to go wrong, that maybe they already had gone wrong. And something else as well, a light fluttery feeling along his skin, a wormy feeling inside his skin. Pressure at his temples. It wasn't the sparrows. At least he didn't think it was. All the same, some mental barometer he hadn't even been aware of was falling, nor was this the first time he'd felt it. There had been a sensation similar to this, although not as strong, when he was on the way to Dave's Market 8 days ago. He had felt it in his own office while he had been getting the files.
a low, jittery feeling. It's Stark. He's with you somehow. In you. He's watching. If you say the wrong thing, he'll know. And then somebody will suffer.
I apologize, he said. He was aware that Raleigh de Lesseps was now standing behind the two policemen, watching Thad with quiet, curious eyes. He would have to start lying now, and the lies came so naturally and smoothly to mind that, for all he knew, they might have been planted there by George Stark himself. He wasn't entirely sure Raleigh would go along, but it was a little late to worry about that.
I'm on edge, that's all.
Understandable, Harrison said. I just want you to realize we're not the enemy, Mr. Beaumont. Thad said, The kid who phoned knew I was here because he was coming out of the bookstore when I drove by. He wanted to know if I was teaching a summer writing course. The faculty telephone directory is divided into departments, the members of each department listed in alphabetical order. The print is very fine, as anyone who has ever tried to use it will testify.
It's a very naughty book that way, Raleigh agreed around his pipe.
The two policemen turned to look at him for a moment, startled. Raleigh favored them with a solemn, rather owlish nod.
Raleigh follows me in the directory listings, Thad said. We don't happen to have any faculty member whose last name begins with C this year.
He glanced at Raleigh for a moment, but Raleigh had taken his pipe from his mouth and appeared to be inspecting its fire-blackened bowl with close attention.
As a result, Thad finished, I'm always getting his calls and he's always getting mine. I told this kid he was out of luck. I'm off until fall.
Well, that was that. He had a feeling he might have over-explained the situation a little, but the real question was when Harrison and Manchester had gotten to the doorway of Raleigh's office and how much they had overheard. One did not ordinarily tell students applying for writing courses that they were biodegrading and that they would soon just crumble to bits.
I wish I was off until fall, Manchester sighed. Are you about done, Mr. Beaumont?
Thad breathed an interior sigh of relief and said, I just have to put back the files I won't be needing.
And a note, you have to write a note to the secretary.
And, of course, I have to write a note to Mrs. Fenton, he heard himself saying. He didn't have the slightest idea why he was saying this, he only knew he had to. She's the English department secretary.
Do we have time for another cup of coffee? Manchester asked.
Sure, maybe even a couple of cookies, if the barbarian hordes left any, he said. That feeling that things were out of joint, that things were wrong and going wronger all the time, was back and stronger than ever.
Leave a note for Mrs. Fenton? Jesus, that was a laugh.
Raleigh must be choking on his pipe. As Thad left Raleigh's office, Raleigh asked,
Can I speak to you for a minute, Thaddeus?
Sure, Thad said. He wanted to tell Harrison and Manchester to leave them alone. He would be right up, but recognized, reluctantly, that such a remark was not exactly the sort of thing you said when you wanted to allay suspicions. And Harrison, at least, had his antennae up. Maybe not quite all the way just yet, but almost. Silence worked better anyway. As he turned to Raleigh, Harrison and Manchester strolled slowly up the hall. Harrison spoke briefly to his partner, then stood in the doorway of the department common room while Manchester hunted up the cookies. Harrison had them in sight, but Thad thought they were out of earshot.
That was quite a tale about the faculty directory, Raleigh remarked, putting the chewed stem of his pipe back in his mouth. I believe you have a great deal in common with the little girl in Saki's The Open Window, Thaddeus. Romance at short notice seems to be your specialty.
Raleigh, this isn't what you think it is.
I don't have the slightest idea what it is, Raleigh said mildly. And while I admit to a certain amount of human curiosity, I'm not sure I really want to know.
Thad smiled a little.
And I did get the clear feeling that you'd forgotten Gonzo Tom Carroll on purpose. He may be retired, but last time I looked, he still came between us in the current faculty directory.
Raleigh, I better get going.
Indeed, Raleigh said. You have a note to write to Mrs. Fenton.
Thad felt his cheeks grow a bit warm. Althea Fenton, the English department secretary since 1961, had died of throat cancer in April.
The only reason I held you at all, Raleigh went on, was to tell you that I may have found what you were looking for, about the sparrows.
Thad felt his heartbeat jog.
What do you mean?
Raleigh led Thad back inside the office and picked up Berenger's Folklore of America.
Sparrows, loons, and especially whippoorwills are psychopomps, he said, not without some triumph in his voice. I knew there was something about whippoorwills.
Psychopomps? Thad said doubtfully.
From the Greek, Brawley said, meaning those who conduct. In this case, those who conduct human souls back and forth between the land of the living and the land of the dead. According to Beringer, loons and whippoorwills are outriders of the living. They are said to gather near the place where a death is about to occur. They are not birds of ill omen. Their job is to guide newly dead souls to their proper place in the afterlife.
He looked at Thad levelly.
Gatherings of sparrows are rather more ominous, at least according to Beringer. Sparrows are said to be the outriders of the deceased.
Which means?
Which means their job is to guide lost souls back into the land of the living. They are, in other words, the harbingers of the living dead.
Rawley took his pipe from his mouth and looked at Thad solemnly.
I don't know what your situation is, Thaddeus, but I suggest caution. Extreme caution. You look like a man who is in a lot of trouble. If there's anything I can do, please tell me.
I appreciate that, Rawley. You've done as much as I could hope for just by keeping quiet.
In that, at least, you and my students seem to be in perfect agreement.
But the mild eyes looking at Thad over the pipe were concerned.
You'll take care of yourself?
I will.
And if those men are following you around to help you in that endeavor, Thaddeus, it might be wise to take them into your confidence.
It would be wonderful if he could, but his confidence in them wasn't the issue. If he really did open his mouth, they would have precious little confidence in him. And even if he did trust Harrison and Manchester enough to talk to them, he would not dare say anything until that wormy, crawly feeling inside his skin went away. Because George Stark was watching him. And he was over the deadline.
Thanks, Rawley.
Rawley nodded, told him again to take care of himself, and then sat down behind his desk. Thad walked back to his own office. 6. And, of course, I have to write a note to Mrs. Fenton. He paused in the act of putting back the last of the files he'd pulled by mistake and looked at his beige IBM Selectric. Just lately, he seemed almost hypnotically aware of all writing instruments, great and small. He had wondered on more than one occasion over the last week if there were a different version of Thad Beaumont inside each one, like evil genies lurking inside a bunch of bottles.
I have to write a note to Mrs. Fenton.
But these days one would more properly use a Ouija board than an electric typewriter to get in touch with the late, great Mrs. Fenton, who had made coffee so strong it could almost walk and talk. And why had he said that anyway? Mrs. Fenton had been the furthest thing from his mind. Thad dropped the last of the non-writing honors files into the file cabinet, closed the drawer, and looked at his left hand. Underneath the bandage, the web of flesh between his thumb and forefinger had suddenly begun to burn and itch. He rubbed his hand against the leg of his pants, but that only seemed to make the itch worse. And now it was throbbing as well. That sensation of deep, baking heat intensified. He looked out his office window. Across Bennett Boulevard, the telephone wires were lined with sparrows. More sparrows stood on the roof of the infirmary, and as he watched, a fresh batch landed on one of the tennis courts. They all seemed to be looking at him. Psychopomps, the harbingers of the living dead. Now a flock of sparrows whirled down like a cyclone of burned leaves and landed on the roof of Bennett Hall.
No,
Thad whispered in a shaky voice. His back was hard with goose flesh. His hand itched and burned. The typewriter. He could get rid of the sparrows and the burning, maddening itch in his hand only by using the typewriter. The instinct to sit down in front of it was too strong to deny. Doing it seemed horribly natural somehow, like wanting to stick your hand in cold water after you had burned it.
I have to write a note to Mrs. Fenton.
You just want to get going by nightfall, or you're going to be one sorry son of a bitch, and you won't be the only one. That itchy, wormy feeling under his skin was getting steadily stronger. It radiated out from the hole in his hand in waves. His eyeballs seemed to be pulsing in perfect sync with that feeling, and in the eye of his mind, the vision of the sparrows intensified. It was the Ridgeway section of Bergenfield. Ridgeway under a mild white spring sky.
It was 1960. The whole world was dead except for these terrible common birds, these psychopomps. And as he watched, they all took wing. The sky went dark with their great wheeling mass. The sparrows were flying again. Outside Thad's window, the sparrows on the wires, the infirmary, and Bennett Hall flew upward together in a whir of wings. A few early students paused in their walk across the quad to watch the flock bank left across the sky and disappear into the west. Thad did not see this. He saw nothing but the neighborhood of his childhood somehow transformed into the weird, dead country of a dream. He sat down in front of the typewriter, sinking deeper into the twilight world of his trance as he did so. Yet one thought held firm. Foxy George could make him sit down and twiddle the keys of the IBM, yes. But he wouldn't write the book, no matter what. And if he held to that, Foxy old George would either fall apart or simply whiff out of existence, like a candle flame. He knew that. He felt it. His hand seemed to be whamming in and out now, and he felt that, if he could see it, it would look like the paw of a cartoon character. Wile E. Coyote, perhaps, after it had been hit with a sledgehammer. It wasn't pain, exactly. It was more like the I'm-going-to-go-crazy-soon feeling you get when the middle of your back, the one place you can never quite reach, starts to itch. Not a surface itch, but that nerve-deep, throbbing itch that makes you clamp your teeth together. But even that seemed distant, unimportant. He sat down at the typewriter. 7. The moment he turned the machine on, the itch went away, and the vision of the sparrows went with it. Yet the trance held, and at the center of it was some harsh imperative. There was something which needed to be written, and he could feel his whole body yelling at him to get to it, do it, get it done. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.